You're listening to Clinical Conversations from the NEJM Group. I'm Joe Elia. A few days ago, The Lancet Oncology published an estimate that oral contraceptive use over the past 10 years had prevented some 200,000 cases of endometrial cancer in developed countries. Along with that research, the journal also published an editorial commentary by our guest, Dr. Nicholas Wenzensen, that I thought the Clinical Conversations audience would find useful. Dr. Wenzensen is a senior investigator at the U.S. National Cancer Institute. Welcome, Dr. Wenzensen. I should mention that you have a co-author on the commentary, Dr. Amy Barrington de Gonzalez, also of the NCI, who's not available today, but we want to give credit where it's due. Your essay offers a kind of potted history of oral contraceptives, and speaking as a cancer epidemiologist, do you think that oral contraceptives are particularly interesting because of their associations both with increased and decreased risk for some conditions?
Absolutely. I think they're fascinating from our perspective because they have been around for such a long time. They were developed for a variety of different indications, and their actual true indication, like the prevention of unwanted pregnancies, was only kind of discovered moving along. And then over the past five decades, there have been a number of benefits and also potential harms identified that have slowly kind of contributed in putting together a very complex set of actions that those OCs have. And I think what is important is that some of those events or some of those benefits and risks are very short-term, and those typically have been observed early on, but others occur much later after use. And so it took quite a while to find those actions of oral contraceptives. And I think the current example, the finding of a reduced risk of endometrial cancer, is an example for such a long-term event that was not immediately clear when they were introduced.
Your commentary had high praise for the paper. What did you find most attractive about the design of the research?
Well, the strength of the current study is that it took pretty much all the epidemiologic studies and combined them in one big analysis on oral contraceptive use and endometrial cancer. We have known for a while that there is a reduced risk of endometrial cancer in oral contraceptive users. I mean, that the first findings were in the 1980s, but the current study was able to put together data from all over the world reflecting different patterns of use over many decades and really come up with a very refined estimate of how much that risk reduction really plays out. What we see often in early findings is we have very unstable estimates. So we see maybe we are lucky and we see a very strong finding early on, and then over time when we add more studies, some tell you the opposite. Some say, well, there's really not much going on. And so you need to really put together many different studies to come to the closer to the true estimate of what is going on. And this is what the current study did. They put together all the evidence out there and did an analysis really focusing on the most important questions. What is the risk reduction? How does that translate into preventing endometrial cancer?
And they concentrated on endometrial cancer. I wonder whether they have the data to do the same study, say, on ovarian cancer. I'm guessing they don't.
They do, actually, and there have been previous publications from the group on ovarian cancer, and there is an update, I think, going on breast cancer. So they actually have data on a number of cancer endpoints from those studies, and I think there are different strategies when doing such a combined analysis. the approach here was to focus on one cancer site and really tease out the effects related to this one cancer. But I think for what matters for physicians and women deciding whether to take oral contraceptives goes beyond that paper, and that is what we wrote about in the editorial, because you have to look at all the potential outcomes, put them together, and then based on all those different effects of oral contraceptives, make a decision whether you should take them or not. And I think ultimately it would be great to see this as a combined analysis from this extensive data set and really look at all the different outcomes together.
What might change in clinicians' conversations with their patients as a result of the of this paper?
Well, I think that clinicians will be more aware of those long-term benefits based on this study and others, and I think when counseling a woman on whether to take oral contraceptives or not, this should be part of the conversation and saying, okay, there are some immediate benefits and risks, and then there are some long-term potential benefits, and now they can really put numbers to that and say, okay, this is the absolute reduction in risk of this particular cancer that they can use for communicating with the individuals. I think at the same time, there is, in our editorial, we reference a manuscript that has attempted to put all the benefits and risks together and estimate whether there is an overall net benefit or harm in taking oral contraceptives. And their conclusion at the time was that there was an overall benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a very general statement, and it is based on a lot of assumptions, and some of those assumptions will change as we have more studies like the one we're talking about now, and we have more accurate estimates. And also, it is important to look into individual subjects, because we also know that a combination of oral contraceptive use and smoking increases the risk of venous thrombosis a lot. So there are a lot of individual components that need to be considered. But I think having those really accurate numbers on potential risk reduction is very helpful for physicians. And I think the other important aspect is that there are now studies ongoing looking into high-risk populations, especially women with a family history of endometrial cancer or breast cancer, and evaluating whether in women with this higher than population risk, using oral contraceptives could lead to cancer prevention. So that is another interesting direction that this is going.
The benefit seems to be at the scale of, I guess I'd call it a public health scale. I mean, the relative risk reduction certainly is significant. It's roughly 25%. The absolute risk is about one percentage point, and it's probably good to keep that in mind.
So the risk
of endometrial cancer is, you know, rather relatively low. The absolute risk is relatively low, but the use of oral contraceptives is something that lowers that risk even more. And it's not like people are taking this drug because it's only lowering their risk for endometrial cancer. I mean, they're using it for birth control and other things. So it's got a major benefit. But the effect that was seen was even when adjusted for smoking history and I believe, and also for family history, was still significant, wasn't it?
Yes, I would have to check all the individual sub-analysis, but overall it played out across different subgroups of different risk levels. But I wanted to come back to what you just said, because you made a really excellent point about the difference in relative risk and absolute risk, and we we have a strong focus on that here in our group, and we're moving more and more towards absolute risk in some of our analysis and studies, because this is what really matters on the population. And relative risk can at times be misleading, because you can see a very high relative risk, but as you said, if there is a very low prevalence of that condition or of that cancer, the absolute difference that this relative risk makes could be very small. So I think this is an important point, but endometrial cancer is the most common gynecologic cancer. I mean, it's much more common than ovarian cancer, so this relative risk makes a bigger difference for endometrial cancer as compared to ovarian cancer on the absolute scale.
So if when your friends ask you, say at a party, well, what about this stuff, what might you say to them? And of course I mean it's all curbside stuff that you're saying, but I'm guessing that you're saying the same things that you're saying to me, that there are risks and benefits, and we're beginning to understand them better. But it's not like a problem in algebra. There's no solution, is there?
Yeah, I mean, it's not that we're not saying you should put OCs in the drinking water at this point. I mean, this is clearly, despite all those nice effects that we're seeing, because there are certain risks, and they can be major events on an individual level, and we have to better understand the trade-off, and also whether there is a certain combination of risk factors that really puts women at a much higher risk of those thromboembolic events, and we know smoking plays an important role. So in the end, there needs to be, at this point, an individual discussion, but I think we are much better in our understanding and of the kind of effects of the individual benefits and harms, and we can lay it out to women, and then they can make an informed decision. At the same time, I think as we move forward and as we understand better the harms, we will refine those numbers, and this will be changing. And also, there has been a continuous change in the formulations of OCs. I mean, initially, the estrogen levels were much higher. Those have been reduced. And this may affect some of the benefits and risks. At this point, it looks like most of the benefits are less dependent on dose, and some of the risks may be reduced in the lower dose formulation. So it's a moving target, but I think we're seeing this. We're looking at the data, and there seems to be kind of an overall benefit on the population level, but that doesn't mean we apply it to everybody in the same way.
Are there other points that you would make, especially for the benefit of clinicians in training?
I mean, I think this study emphasizes the importance of really the value of long-term observational studies. I mean, in medicine, we are used to evaluating drugs in clinical trials and to evaluate their performance for our main outcomes, and also look at adverse events. But this is typically restricted to a short period of time after use or during use, and then we have a very controlled situation where we can evaluate those short-term actions. But there are long-term actions of many drugs that we will never see in those clinical trials, A, because they occur much later, and B, because those trials are not necessarily powered to detect endometrial cancer endpoints. So I think the observational studies are an important complement in evaluating kind of long-term actions and actions on less prevalent disease, and I think this is a great example for that.
So the lesson is just to keep observing. Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Wenzensen, for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was our 181st Clinical Conversation. All the rest can be found at podcasts.jwatch.org. My executive producer is Kristen Kelly. My thanks to Amy Herman, the editor of Physicians First Watch, for suggesting this topic. We come to you from the NEJM Group. Thank you for listening. Please send your comments to jelia@nejm.org. See you next time.